Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Environmental Unconscious, Ecological Poetics from Spencer to Milton, by Stephen Swarbrick. Narrated by Mitch Crawford. Introduction. This book argues that four early modern poets, Edmund Spencer, Walter Raleigh, Andrew Marvell, and John Milton, advanced a poetic materialism not only at odds with the empirical science of their time, but also one that challenges theoretical inclinations in the new materialisms today. The new and old materialisms both propose a return to matter in order to overcome loss. For early modern materialists like Francis Bacon, the loss was empirical knowledge. Now, for the new materialists, it is the loss of more-than-human life worlds. By contrast, this book demonstrates that Spencer, Raleigh, Marvell, and Milton used their poems to teach readers how to enjoy loss. Moreover, it argues that a poetry that invites us to enjoy loss is of radical importance to ecological politics today. Writing at the dawn of the Anthropocene, when nature's resources seemed limitless and the risk of loss merely contingent with respect to the wealth and freedom promised by capitalism, Spencer, Raleigh, Marvell, and Milton crafted an ecological poetics in which loss was no longer contingent, but rather constitutive of desire. This focus on the pleasures of loss presents a new kind of materialism. Following a reading tradition running from Lucretius to Lacan, I argue that these writers invite us to read matter as structured by loss, just like poetic form. By aligning matter with poetic form, these poets not only took pleasure in the dissatisfactions of the present, but also resisted the promise of future gain. Recent studies in early modern eco-criticism have devoted considerable attention to the natural historical underpinnings of early modern literature. Laurie Shannon has posited a human-animal cosmopolitics in the time of Shakespeare. Dan Brayton and Steve Mentz have each cast sails in the maritime literature of early modernity. Jonathan Goldberg, Stephen Greenblatt, and others have revealed a sub-representational level of atomic Lucretian matter or seeds, and Philip John Usher has extracted a subterranean awareness of early modern geomedia. Although these and other eco-critical projects have done much to reveal the articulate relations that early modern materialism makes possible, they leave underexplored the disarticulating force of matter, its semiotic excess. Gerard Passanante refers to this disarticulating power as the catastrophizing power of materialism, leaning on the sense of strophe as a turning that turns the poetic imagination against itself. By not attending to this catastrophic power, we, post-humanists, produce instead a hyper-humanism that sees matter from the perspective of the human subject alone. Rather than foregrounding materialism's explosive force, eco-criticism has become a vehicle for the humanist belief that matter and meaning must coincide. To attend to materialism's explosive force, this book develops an environmental poetics that investigates the complex relations among new and old materialist discourses, environmental theory, and an early modern poetry pierced by lack. The writers in this study all shape their poems around objects that fail to satisfy. The truth that Spencer's Red Cross Knight pursues is forever unclaimed, coming only in the form of a trauma enacted on trees. Likewise, Raleigh's pursuit of wealth ends disastrously in the tropics, where local ecologies disrupt his adventures. Marvell's vision of home vanishes in the time-lapse of history, and Milton's paradise proves a site of loss and contradiction. Although the poets in this study partake of the early modern fascination with material objects, evidenced by the historical rise of empiricism, colonial extraction, and aesthetic realism, the materialism they put forth is highly counterintuitive. Theirs is a materialism without matter, because it gives priority to the structuring role of the unconscious in psychic life. Taking a page from psychoanalytic theorists like Lacan, the environmental unconscious asserts that matter, far from being immediate, knowable, or countable, houses an incognizable lack. This lack underpins the subject of eco-criticism while pinning that subject to the singular nub of their enjoyment, what Lacan calls syntôme. The syntôme refers to the missing signifier of desire, that which is in the other more than the other, in the world more than the world, and which sustains the subject's libidinal circuit while remaining unknowable and unspeakable. A kernel of jouissance that resists symbolization, the syntôme in Lee Edelman's queer reading of Lacan, binds the subject to its constitutive libidinal career and assures that no subject, try as it may, can ever get over itself. Get over, that is, the fixation of the drive that determines its jouissance. The syntôme functions as a point of attraction and bewilderment, organizing the subject's libidinal career while endangering the subject's illusory identity. This, then, the syntôme as the locus of the drive, is what the ecological subject cannot get over. Indeed, despite its many attempts at surpassing, post-humanizing, and networking its way into harmonious accord with the web of life, where all is entangled, the ecological subject cannot surpass or entangle the obscene jouissance at its core, since this core of enjoyment paradoxically sustains the ecological subject as a breach or tear. Hence Lacan's rewriting of existence as existence, a formalization of the inexorable ek, out, or exit from concrete reality that the syntôme ever bordering on madness names. Ingeniously, Edelman calls this mode of existence syntomosexuality, and aligns it with queer subjects who refuse the relentless pull of reproductive futurity. For my part, I offer the term syntomoenvironmentality, a precursor, if you will, to Edelman's queer syntôme in that it pays tribute to Lacan's pre-modern etymology. Syntôme is an old way of spelling that was subsequently spelt symptôme. Syntôme environmentality invites greater appreciation of the eco-negativity at the heart of life, a negativity that throws life into contradiction, perforates matter, haunts ecological subjectivity with its own abject enjoyment, and, what is more, gives the subject its freedom to enjoy beyond the network of objects and their relations. Desire, so conceived, has no object and thus no relation. The eco-psychoanalysis I model in this book is radically non-object-oriented. If this merger of eco-psychoanalysis sounds like a strong theory out of joint with the current fashion of weak epistemology in that it uses a universalist language to examine ideas like the split subject, the unconscious, and desire as such, it is. The poets in this study exemplify a universal failure of language that could, why not, be applied to other poets in other periods. I assemble these poets not like the beads of a rosary moving from one casual connection to the next, as in Walter Benjamin's metaphor of what historicism does. Instead, I adopt a strong methodology of reading for exemplarity. There was a time not long ago when reading for exemplarity was alive and well. William Empson's Seven Types of Ambiguity, for example, or, in the 1990s, Joan Kopczak's Read My Desire. The first would be impossible today. The second is a clarion call against the strictures of historicism, which Kopczak links to the notion of immanence. When everything is immanent, entangled, or enmeshed, when the outside has been curtained off, Kopczak argues, one thing is undoubtedly missing: desire. That is because desire can only appear as a fissure in the web of life. Since Kopchak's writing in 1994, the situation has only gotten worse for desiring subjects. "Always historicize" has become the drumbeat of the humanities and environmental humanities. Theories of immanence are everywhere. But as biospheric conditions continue to unravel, as the capitalist death machine continues to speed up, and as the crisis of the humanities worsens from austerity, I am convinced of nothing more than the urgency of big, symptomatic readings. Today's task isn't to historicize. The task is to symptomatize. "Enjoy your symptom" is the battle cry of psychoanalytic eco-criticism. Building on the path-breaking eco-materialism of medieval and early modern scholars like Jonathan Gill Harris, Karen Raber, Carl Steele, and Julian Yates, and focusing on the surplus vitality of psychoanalytic theories of desire, as articulated by Edelman, Mary Rutte, and others, this book foregrounds the compromised workings of the environmental unconscious with its intrusions and interruptions, slips of the real, into the steady flow of life and meaning as the poetic underside of environmental thought. Each of my chapters reads material objects, including trees, oceans, rivers, animal dwellings, plants, and fossils, as poetic forms demanding our close analysis, not because of their supposed there-ness, signaling the great outdoors in Quentin Meyersu's sense, but because of their failure to be there. Encircling endlessly around ciphered objects, these poets reveal that loss is central to the enjoyment poetry offers, and that nature offers. They offer readers an environmental poetics in which loss is not the obstacle to desire, but its aim. Materialism's absent center. By aligning materialism with poetic form, this book makes a critical intervention in the materialist turn currently sweeping the theoretical landscape. This new wave of materialisms includes the agential realism of Karen Barad, the transcorporeality of Stacy Alimo, the hyperobjects of Timothy Morton, and the actor network theory of Bruno Latour. I use the phrase new materialisms in this book as shorthand for several related discourses, including animal studies, posthumanism, and eco-criticism. The new materialisms emphasize that matter and meaning are entwined. Not only that, this entwinement necessitates responsiveness to the non-human bodies and artifacts that make up the human world. The goal of the new materialisms has been to place special emphasis on relations of care and mutuality among human and non-human actors, and to develop ways of dismantling the hegemony of the human in appreciation of a wider world of matter. The emphasis on matter in new materialist philosophies, including affect theory, object-oriented ontology, cognitive literary studies, and environmental criticism, is itself a direct response to the growing concern, though it is a concern that has been growing at least since Plato, that reading, which is by definition belated and thus out of step with the present demand, has delayed our attention to bodies and things for long enough, and that what truly matters now is that we attend urgently, ethically, and compassionately to matter. Precisely. The return to matter is staged as a return to an ethics and politics of repair, one in which we, having regained the great outdoors, work to rebuild a common world. Bruno Latour's landmark essay, "Why Has Critique Run Out of Steam?", which is less a postmortem on critique than it is a kind of critique of critique, ends with exactly this call to rebuild and to multiply the commons. He asks, what would critique do if it could be associated with more, not with less, with multiplication, not subtraction. The emphasis here, as in all Latourian-inspired criticism, is to have done with linguistic reductionism, the reduction of all matters to a single surface of sense, by forging a common life world. Getting real, then, is not only a materialist or scientific endeavor, it is also a matter of care and ethical responsibility. Increasingly, the spirit of our times demands that we stop taking the long way around by reading matter as a signifying chain, a chain without a final destination, and instead extend our care to the immediate, the visceral, and the literal thing. What the new materialisms all say, without always exactly saying it, is that close attention to language is not only escapist, but worse, simply beside the point. New materialists assume that matter must mean. Matter must mean because, as Karen Barad writes in the opening sentences of Meeting the Universe Halfway, matter and meaning are not separate elements. They are inextricably fused together, and no event, no matter how energetic, can tear them asunder. Yet while Barad and others define their materialism against the deracinated materialism of the Enlightenment, which privileged the human knower over and against the natural world, there is on this essential point, the fusion of matter and meaning, very little difference between Barad's materialism and that of naturalist philosopher and early modern humanist Francis Bacon, who, though charged with bringing about the death of nature and the extirpation of animism, sought not just to re-educate his readers about the natural world, but to rediscover in the world of things the primordial accord between matter and the senses. For Bacon, too, matter must mean. Not only human knowledge, but also human salvation depended on it. According to Joanna Picciotto, Bacon attributed an apparent design flaw, the maladaptation of human perception to the scope of creation, to original sin. Consequently, Bacon's advocacy of a new science required a new understanding of the senses. For created humanity, Picciotto writes, divine worship was indistinguishable from satisfying the cognitive appetite. By contrast, the question for fallen humanity was, according to Bacon, what is creation before the fallen body and mind experience it? It is this unique understanding of the maladaptation of the fallen senses to the natural world, a view that left open the possibility of their improvement, that radically distinguished Bacon's reformist project from other like-minded reformers who shared the zeal for returning to things themselves. Earlier figures, such as Paracelsus, had already denounced the bookishness of humanist learning in favor of the immediacy of the first book, the Book of Nature, which he proposed revealed the imprints, or signatures, of the divine verbum Dei. But whereas Paracelsus imagined the divine signatures to be accessible to humanity's exegetical practices, Bacon demurred, arguing instead that the stable link between signatures and the divine, signs and signified, had been lost. What was left to humanity were the senses, wayward and needing reform. Bacon worked to make visible the material causes or originals of sensory experience through a progressive de-education of the senses. He tried, in other words, to reclaim paradise. Centuries later, we are still searching for Bacon's paradisal object, precisely what he made the object of his scientific reforms, as did Immanuel Kant and the speculative realists after him. Unlike the poets in this study, however, the turn to matter in contemporary literary and cultural criticism does not just hinge on a revival of early modern materialism, Lucretius and Spinoza, among others. It dampens early modern materialism's explosiveness. Bacon's paradisal object, Jane Bennett and Latour's re-enchanted object, are both immaculate objects, both beneficiaries of the communicative ideal that matter and meaning must cohere. For these thinkers, no less than Bacon, human salvation depends on it. The new materialist faith in matter ultimately redounds on the humanist subject whose place in the world is again guaranteed and redeemed by interconnection. At precisely the moment when these and other thinkers turn to matter, they turn away from matter by making all things, from animals to plants to minerals, synonymous with human meaning. Far from surpassing Bacon's brand of materialism, the new materialisms repeat it unconsciously. The neo-vitalist reads life into matter in order to explain how all matter works to assemble in the making of more than human life worlds. The affect theorist reads affect or emotion or mood in the immediate and recognizable sensations of the lived body. The speculative realist reads traces of the pre-human past in the most absolute of ideal objects, mathematics. And the eco-critic, together with the post-humanist, joins hands with the naive realist by reading matter, animals, plants, and minerals, as words made flesh. At its worst, the turn to matter suggests that reading itself is beside the point. Reading simply unveils bodies, objects, things. For example, the brain as the answer to the problem of sense, or the animal as the answer to the problem of ethics. What we have now more than ever is an abundance of matters serving, as they did for Bacon, as answers to the problem of sense. Yet for all of that, we have a dearth of any real readings. And that is because language, the operator of sense, so conceived by the new materialisms, isn't materialist at all. It is Adamic. Just as Adam named the first creatures, welcoming them inside the human fold, so the Baconian naturalist and new materialist meet on the same plane of human meaning. They both make the human master of his own house by endowing him with a language perfectly fitted to his environment. Consequently, we have been living for some time in the stifled terrain of what environmental philosopher Frederic Nerat calls saturated immanence, when everything is brought inside the house of human meaning, and it becomes impossible, indeed mad, to think matter from without, to think the outside. In their introduction to New Materialisms, Diana Kuhl and Samantha Frost state, "In the history of philosophy, materialism has remained a sporadic and often marginal approach, for there is an apparent paradox in thinking about matter. As soon as we do so, we seem to distance ourselves from it, and within the space that opens up, a host of immaterial things seems to emerge: language, consciousness, subjectivity, agency, mind, soul." True enough, when one sets out to think about matter, one often encounters a gap. Nevertheless, just as it would be misguided, according to the authors, to fill in that gap with matters of the soul, I argue that it is equally misguided to fill it in with bodies, objects, things. Why? For the simple but important reason that matter, like language, is not all. When one looks to matter, one encounters a minus. Indeed, there would be no thinking at all without the encounter with this minus. Without a tear in our vision of the world, there would be no consequence to our readings, and hence no readings. Matter would simply cohere. Lucretius to the letter. At the heart of this problem in new materialist discourse lies a misreading of atomist poet and philosopher Lucretius, a misreading that, as I've been arguing, counterintuitively aligns contemporary new materialism more closely with Francis Bacon than their supposed inspiration. The eco-critic or the science studies scholar turns to Lucretius to show that matter speaks. It articulates relations among elements, as does language, with or without the human. In the epoch of the Anthropocene, in which we are compelled to envision a world without humans, the insight into non-human language is critical, a point I return to later. However, it also sacrifices one of the principal lessons of the linguistic turn, that language itself is implicated in a gap. Lucretius calls this gap void. By insisting that matter and meaning are indissoluble, the new materialisms provide an abundance of significant matters. But this insistence masks a prior refusal, the refusal, namely, to grapple with matter's incompletion or the structural non-identity of matter language. This non-identity is something that Lucretius insists upon. In De Rerum Natura, Lucretius compares atoms to alphabetic letters. Like letters, Lucretius argues, tropological arrangements structure the whole universe. Now do you see the point of my previous remark, Lucretius asks, that it makes a great difference in what combinations and positions the same elements occur, and what motions they mutually pass on and take over, so that with a little reshuffling, the same ones may produce forests and fires. This is just how the words themselves are formed, by a little reshuffling of the letters, when we pronounce forests and fires as two distinct utterances. In Lucretius's analogy, the material word is no less dependent on the combinations and positions of atoms to make sense of reality, to make distinctions, say, between forests and forest fires, than the letters that compose the words forests and fires. Both letters and atoms make sense because they are a priori gatherings. The same elements compose sky, sea and lands, rivers and sun, crops, trees and animals, but they are moving differently and in different combinations. Moreover, the letters which denote sky, sea, earth and rivers also denote crops, trees and animals. What Lucretius describes is not a world of things, but, as Jacques Lesra has argued, a world of events. The whole of De Rerum Natura can be said to constitute a radical declination in the history of philosophy because it affirms that, in fact, everything is an event. Happenings rather than things. Becomings rather than being. It makes little difference in this case whether we are talking about atoms or letters, since atoms and letters are composed of the same stuff. Lucretius's comparison between atoms and letters has been at the forefront of new materialist readings. Whereas the linguistic turn is said to have left the material at the wayside, the turn to matter now hails matter as a sense-making in its own right. Matter is said to organize, to assemble, to affect and be affected, to trigger events, to become, to possibilize and depossibilize, to create vital networks, to democratize, to give voice, to usher in the open, to animate, and above all, to make live. Matter has become a surrogate for language and matters of representation because matter, read in the Lucretian vein, is already sense-making. The signifier and the symbolic are at best redundancies, and the linguistic turn was already the material in sheep's clothing. What the new materialisms neglect is the asyntaxis that Lucretius builds into his philosophical system. For the new materialist, matter makes sense. It is geared toward relations and becomings that echo symbolic structures of meaning. In the environmental unconscious, the point is just the opposite. For it is not the case that matter as language is only sense-making. Matter, as Lucretius shows, is built on a foundation of nonsense, of letters with no natural order, logic, or syntactic belonging. despite the now ubiquitous refrain on matters since making a
sample complete. Ready to continue?